The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our award-winning author events series, recorded live at the Parkway Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, our unique and inspiring collections, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Welcome to the Free Library of Philadelphia, and thank you very much for joining us. I'm Laura Kovacs, and I'm honored to be here. In her novels, children's books, essays, and reviews, Hilma Wolitzer captures time and character and illuminates the dark interiors of the American home. Her many honors include fellowships from the Guggenheim Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts, and an award in literature from the American Academy of Arts and Letters. Her 14th book, Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket, is a career-spanning collection of short stories, including the title story, first published in 1966 in the Saturday Evening Post. On this very special evening, she'll be joined in conversation with her daughter, best-selling novelist Meg Wolitzer. Thank you so much for being here. The screen is all yours.
Thank you, Laura. I'm really thrilled to be here again in conversation with my mother, because the truth is, if I weren't in conversation with you, Mom, on a webinar in front of lots of people, I would be doing it privately with you. It being the evening, we'd be talking on the phone, but it's
a total treat. Crossword puzzle together.
Yes, we'd be doing crossword puzzles on the phone, but we will not be treating the audience to that tonight. Instead, we're going to talk about your book, which is so beautiful, and I love holding it up and having that kind of show and tell. Now, of course, I do know the answer to this question, so it's a little bit of a fake, but I think that when you talk about it, I get some new information about it every time. In your view, how did this book come about?
Well, it would not have come about if it were not for you. Both Dad and I contracted COVID, and we were both in the hospital, in separate hospitals. And he was much sicker than I was, and he died 2 days before I came home. And by the time I came home, I was still feeling very ill and grieving terribly. And I think you wanted to just make me feel better. And you said you had been reading my stories and thought that they would make a good collection. And at first I wasn't interested at all because I just felt so rotten emotionally and physically. And then I realized that I needed something to do. After a while, I realized I needed something to do besides grieve, and I needed something to look forward to. And I began to be interested in this, and it became a project that you were deeply involved in. And I'm very grateful to you for it, because it made a very big difference in my ability to get well and to go on.
Oh, good. I'm glad to hear that. I mean, it obviously was a terrible, terrible time. But what happened was, while you were in the hospital recovering, I was at home, you know, feeling very upset about everything that happened, and we weren't able to be together. And I started finding your old stories. Some of them are online. The Esquire had put them online for a while, but I had copies of magazines that they'd been in. And I was just starting to look at them. And this is like, this is not nepotistic flattery. It's genuine. I was so struck by how free they were. And you know, when you're young and your mother is a novelist or a short story writer, as you were first, you just feel pride if you're me. I mean, but I didn't necessarily understand what you were doing. Later, when I became a writer, I did. And we talked about writing a lot, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But when your first stories came out, and the first one, in fact, which is the title story, Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket, appeared in 1966. And the title was so great. And I remember seeing the magazine when you got it, and it was so thrilling. It was, my mom is suddenly a short story writer, and nobody else who I knew in our town had a mother who was doing that, but I didn't understand it. But now when I read it, not only do I understand again, as I did when I was a younger writer, how good you are and how good this story is, but the freedom of it really struck me. And I would love to hear a little bit about how you came to find your voice. I mean, that word, that it gets so overused, but it's absolutely true with you. How did you find this way of writing? Because it's funny.
I think that it was partly because I was in those days sort of shy. And if I had to get off up before a group of people or on something like this, like a Zoom event, I would probably feel faint with embarrassment and feeling shy. And I was able to be more expressive on the page. I was able to be rowdier, noisier. And it was a kind of freedom.
Do you care about what people think of you less on the page than in person, or vice versa?
Still, unfortunately, at 91, I still care what people think of me, about what people think of me, both on the page, truthfully, and in person, but less about how they care about me on the page. I feel that it's not just my own voice, it's the voices of my characters. So I feel I'm in a comfortable crowd of people. It's not just me who's on the page. There are other people on the page too, the people in my imagination.
Do you feel a responsibility to them, conveying them correctly?
Yeah, well, I do feel you don't have to write about likable characters. There's been a great deal in the literary news about that. But I think you have to care about what happens to them, that you also have a responsibility, even if they're unlikable, maybe especially if they're unlikable, to present them in full human dimension. You don't see them just as villains, perhaps, or heroes, but they're flawed and they're human, or at least you try to convey them that way.
Do you know what you're trying to do when you write a short story? Like, what do you know?
I don't know. I find out what I know by writing. When I start a short story, I start it the way poets very often begin poems, with just a line. And very often the line is spoken in the first person. So I could sort of say, I hear voices like Joan of Arc, and I hear this voice and it says a sentence. And if it's followed by another sentence and another one, then I may have a story. Sometimes it just ends after several sentences or even a couple of hundred pages, and it just doesn't work. And you have to set it aside. But writers are very thrifty. And I usually find that I can use some of the discarded work somewhere else in a new piece of work, a sentence or two that fits.
It's like making soup, right? There's something you can throw in to a particular.
I think of it making potholders out of rags or something.
I like our domestic our kitchen imagery. Yes, stuck in the kitchen. Well, let's talk for a second about that early story, and then I want to jump to talking about the late story, the last story in the book. So when you started writing Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket, which was referred to in a review on NPR as the greatest title of, by Heller McAlpin, the critic, as maybe the greatest title of the year, or one of the greatest titles of the year. It is a great title. Do you remember writing that story and what you were trying to do? What is it about?
It wasn't actually, we didn't have a title, and actually it was the first line of the story, and I just moved it up to become the title.
Did you know what, would you tell everybody a little bit about what it's about?
Well, the title is literal. It's about a woman who has a nervous breakdown in the aisle of a supermarket, but it's also metaphorical in that it's about the feeling that women had in those days, and maybe in these days as well, that they were very involved with their domestic lives and maybe even enjoyed it. And I enjoyed mine very much. I love being a wife and mother and a cook and bottle washer, but I also felt restless and felt that there had to be something else I wanted to do. And I think the story reflects that. And writing a story reflects how I felt about it.
Right. Well, now let's jump to the end. So back to how this book came about. When we were looking through the stories, when you got well, we started looking through the stories together and ordering them. And it was so exciting to do that. I mean, we were doing this from our separate homes because we still couldn't be together. This was pre-vaccine. Nobody knew anything, what was going on. So we were on the phone sort of talking about the order of the stories, almost as if we were hanging a show of your work in a gallery. And it became clear that it would be so wonderful if you could write one more story.
And I hadn't written any fiction for quite a while. I can't remember when my last novel
came out in 2012, An Available Man.
Wonderful. Right. And I hadn't written any short fiction for a very long while. And suddenly I found myself compelled to write a short story. And it's the most autobiographical story I've ever written. I always feel protective of my family, of people I love and people I know, and don't want to expose anybody's lives on the page. I feel it's better to make things up. But this story, right after Dad died and right after I recovered from COVID, and COVID was still rampant as it still is, and I felt I really needed to write about that. I needed to write about a long marriage like mine and how it ends with COVID. And it was painful to write, but it was also cathartic. Somehow getting it down on the page made me understand it a little better. The times were so strange. When I say I was grieving, but there were none of the rituals that one goes through in grieving. There was no seeing, none of us saw Dad while he was dying. None of us saw each other. I came home and nobody was here. And all of the artifacts of his life were here. His glasses were on the bed. His shoes were next to the bed. And we didn't have a funeral. He was cremated with no one to see him off. And all this was so terribly upsetting. And I think that writing about it was a way of, it was a new way of mourning.
I'm wondering now, I've never thought about it this way before, but I'm wondering if, in a sense, the writing of the story became the ritual, part of the ritual.
Yeah, I do think it was. And we did eventually have a memorial service for Dad exactly a year to the day after he died. I didn't think I could deal with it before then, but I think writing the story helped me get there, having people respond to the story.
Well, the story was online in Lit Hub and just had a big
electric response. Literature.
Electric literature. I'm sorry. Forgive me. I can't keep track of your wild life, many things. Forgive me. Electric literature. Wonderful site. Why don't you actually give us a kind of amuse-bouche, like the free stuff you get when you sit down at a restaurant, a little bit from the story and maybe set it up for the viewers?
I will set it up by saying that since this is a Zoom event, and it took me quite a while to get the hang of Zoom, my very first Zoom experience was somebody's birthday party. And for some reason, I thought I had a touch screen on my computer, even though I didn't. I didn't use the mouse. I just kept poking the screen with my finger and nothing happened. So in honor of that, this is in the middle of the story, The Great Escape, the final story in the collection. And it is about a Zoom group. And the characters in this story are almost 90 years old, almost all of them. I like to write about people younger than I am. It was my friend Ruth's turn to host our book group. But on the advice of her son, Jeffrey, a radiologist, she called everyone to change the venue. We were going to have a Zoom meeting, whatever that was, instead of convening at her place. There was much nervous back and forth among the members of the group about this latest development. It sounded easy enough, though. We'd all receive a link, and at the specified time, we would simply open it and go from there. Ours was strictly a women's group, and the few husbands still around were usually banned from our meetings. whenever it was my turn, I took my laptop into the living room where the refreshments were laid out, and Howard skulked off to the bedroom like a grounded teenager, closing the door behind him. But the Zoom meeting changed all of that. Enough aloneness. We had to stick together. Ruth, long a widow, would have Jeffrey right beside her to help facilitate things. And I invited Howard to sit next to me on the bed with a laptop between us. I hit the link and we waited, the way our ancestors must have waited for the flickering magic lantern to do its thing. After what seemed like a long time, the screen filled with a notice that our meeting would begin soon. Well, this is exciting, I said. Mrs. Bridge was my favorite novel, with its brief, brilliant paragraphs like vaudeville blackouts, and characters I would think about wistfully, as if they were old friends with whom I'd lost touch. I loved Mrs. Bridge, even when she exasperated me. She was the product of her circumstances, of her time and place. But I still wanted her to have more insight and more courage, and to make better choices, the way I had once wished for a happier outcome for Emma Bovary and Anna Karenina. I was gripping my dog-eared, underlined book and looking forward to saying some of all that when our meeting began, if it ever did. Suddenly, Ruth's and Jeffrey's faces loomed before us, almost as big as life. They were both wearing the kind of masks my daughter Anne said you couldn't buy anymore for love or money. Then one of them seemed to bark piercingly, and Jeffrey shouted, "Mute, Evelyn, mute!" Evelyn Lasky and Mildred, her ancient, incontinent, and yappy Maltese. "How?" Evelyn cried. Oh, what do I do?" while Mildred barked in frantic unison. "Just hit your damn mute button," Jeffrey commanded through his mask, as muffled and menacing as Darth Vader. "And shut that dog up." So much for his bedside manner, I thought, but didn't say. What if I wasn't muted either? Then the faces of all the other women in our group popped up, in our book group popped up, each in a separate little frame, like the celebrities on Hollywood squares. Some of the women's mouths were moving soundlessly. Only Evelyn's frame was empty until she whizzed by calling, "Mildred, stay, come." "Everyone else unmute," Jeffrey ordered. And soon there was a cacophony of voices, a chorus of confusion and dismay. And someone's cell phone chirped and chirped. "So this is what I've been missing all these years," Howard said. Then Ruth was in the center of the screen again, sans Jeffrey, holding up her copy of Mrs. Bridge and wiggling it. "Settle down, people," she said, like the middle school teacher she had once been. "Now, who would like to begin?" I raised my hand and leaned eagerly forward, the way I had in AP English, just as the connection was broken and everyone grew silent and disappeared.
That's great. That's so great.
I hope you all haven't disappeared.
No, I am sure they have not. I love that. I want to veer off. We were talking about sad things, but you're a very, very funny writer. You've always been a really funny writer. How does humor get into fiction? Is it sort of like, do you water it like a plant? I mean, how does it get there?
Well, you're very funny too, so I think you really know. It's just the other side of darkness. Sometimes I just see everything as being absurd. Even the worst situation, something strikes me funny. Someone else laughing strikes me funny. It's like yawning, or it's contagious. I hate to use that word right now, but laughter seems to me the saving grace we have, and especially at times like this.
And it can land in a story that is poignant. Humorous moments land in a very different way. They punctuate, right? They almost bring out something. They almost bring out
the contrast between the darkness and the lightness. And in this particular story, dark things do happen. But before they happen, there are a lot of hilarious moments, like a Zoom meeting where nobody knows what they're doing, and a dog barks, and phones go off, and then the screens go dark.
Right. Did you, let's go back a few more years before you were 91. I can't believe you were 91. I remember when you turned 40, I bought you a card, and I went to the store, and I'd never bought a card on my own. And they said, "Do you want the envelope?" And I said, "No," thinking it would cost extra, and ran out.
I was scared. I don't know why I find things funny.
I know. So go back, take me back, because you don't forget anything from your whole life. Take me back to when you knew you were talented, or your early years thinking about that.
Well, I can't say I knew I was talented. I began writing really bad poems when I was a child, and I didn't grow up in a literary household. There weren't many books around, and I can't say my parents discouraged my writing poems, but they didn't pay too much attention to it until my mother had a parent-teacher conference with, I believe it was my fourth grade teacher, Miss Fredericks. And teachers were revered in our household, maybe in all households then, as they should be today. And my mother came home glowing and reported to my father that Miss Fredericks had said, "Hilma shows great promise." And because of that, my awful little poems took on some importance. And my parents played cards a few nights a week. And they began to ask me to recite my poems to the card players, who really were not interested, but were very courteous, listened, applauded, and then went back to the next hand. But I felt that I was launched by this teacher's remark. And then fast forward about 50 years, and I was a published writer, and I was giving a reading in a library in New Jersey. And after the reading, a very tiny, very old woman came up to me and said, "Hilma, you don't remember me. I'm Miss Fredericks. I was your fourth grade teacher." And I was overwhelmed, and overwhelmed her. I began to gush. "Oh, Miss Fredericks, you changed my whole life. You gave me such early encouragement because you told my mother that I showed great promise." And she looked at me and she said, "Oh, honey, I told that to all the mothers," which really put me in my place.
But it's such a great story, though. It's absolutely great. But teachers have, I think both of us have gotten a lot from teachers in our lives. And you had another teacher much later on in the first writing workshop that you ever took. Talk about that class, because for me, just from my personal vantage point, on Mondays, my mother went into the city and my father made sloppy joes from a can, which I did not love and tolerated, because you were off doing something that I didn't quite understand, because I was really young at the time, maybe 5 or 6 when you started. But talk about that class that you took, and I think it really was life-changing.
It was life-changing for me. I had written a couple of short stories, and I decided to take this beginner's workshop at the new school, which was being taught by Anatole Broillard. And when I got to the class, there were about 50 people. It was jam-packed, and he had read all the manuscripts. We were all accepted into the class on the basis of our manuscripts. And I knew he was going to call on me first, because he was having so much trouble announcing my name. And he asked me to come to the front of the room and read the story aloud. And again, I was very shy in those days. And he embarrassed me further by asking me to spit out my gum. And I had no place to put it, so I think I spit it out into my purse. And I came to the front of the room and I read the story as quickly as I could, without any expression whatsoever, hyperventilating all the way, and then collapsed into my seat. And Anatole then called on the class, asked who would like to comment on the story, and a man raised his hand, I remember very languidly, and said, "That was the most boring thing I ever heard." And that was the first criticism I had ever heard of one of my stories. Well, I was just ready to pack it in, to go home and just be a housewife and a mother and not a writer for the rest of my life. But Anatole passed me a note and it just said, the story is fine, see me later. And then he said to the to my critic, you certainly can find the story boring, but you have an obligation to tell the writer why and how you think she might make it better. And in that moment, I learned something about revision and about teaching, which I later became a teacher of or a leader of writing groups. And the note, after I looked at the note, he said, I went up to see him and he said, I'm putting you into an advanced workshop. It's like skipping from the first to the third grade. It was thrilling. And he had me read the story for that group as well, a smaller, more distinguished group. And they didn't like it either. But they gave me constructive criticism and they said it in a way that I could deal with it. I could accept it and began to think about how I would make the story better. And that was the beginning for me.
And you'd never been to college, so.
No. I graduated from high school at 16. I went to a really kind of a tough high school in a tough neighborhood. And Marie Sendak and I graduated together. I was 16, I think he was 18. We sat next to each other in major art. I think we both couldn't wait to get out of there. And years later, we had the same editor and we ended up at a dinner together. And I said to him, Maurice, you and I graduated and everybody else was sent up the river.
So you didn't go to college. You took this class for many years, right? And there was like many iterations of this workshop, right?
I was left back for years.
And then you became a teacher yourself of writing and you've taught it incredibly at Breadloaf, the Breadloaf Writers Conference at the University of Iowa Writers Workshop at Columbia, at NYU, at very distinguished places. How do you know how to teach? Is it just from the way you were taught?
It was from the way I was taught and it was a kind of intuitive sense of how to make stories better by rewriting my own stories. I felt revision was the most important part of writing and the greatest fun, because the first draft always needs work. I can't imagine anybody, well, I'm sure there are people who publish first drafts, but I never could. And I found that by talking about revision and I also allowed people in the class to speak. I didn't feel Anatole did the same thing. He did not overwhelm them, but he'd intervene if he felt people were being cruel or not constructive in some way. And I followed that way of teaching. I think I learned a lot from that. And I learned a lot from my students as well. I mean, I had such distinguished students. Michael Cunningham was a student. Ethan Kanan was a student. They knocked me out. I mean, they were really great writers and they were great writers even then. And not only that, they were modest and they took criticism to heart. That was an amazing experience. And the fact that I could teach on a graduate level and even be, I can't remember what kind of professor I was, an assistant professor or something, and I didn't even have a college degree. Your publications become your credentials if you're teaching writing. And I went to Breadloaf as a scholar, a 40-year-old scholar as it was, with no book published yet. And I didn't think I'd ever go back because there was a terrible hierarchy. The fellows didn't speak to the scholars and the staff, it seemed, only spoke to God. It was just really... It was very intimidating. But
just for people who don't know, Breadloaf, just to explain what it is.
It's changed over the years. It's a conference. It was 12 days in August in the mountains near Middlebury, Vermont. Beautiful place, wonderful weather, and marvelous people, as it turned out, friends who have had for a lifetime. now. I ended up teaching there for about 20 years alongside my friend, the poet Linda Paston, to whom I still speak at least twice a week on the phone. But I didn't think I would ever go back because of that hierarchy. But when I went back as a fellow, I did speak to the scholars and to the contributors because I remembered how it felt to be ostracized or looked down upon. And it's embarrassing when you're 40 and they're 25. It's even more embarrassing. And I remember one time there was a cottage called Treeman where we would all go to have drinks, fellows and faculty, before lunch and before dinner. And occasionally they would invite somebody who wasn't a fellow, or like somebody who was a waiter or somebody who was a scholar. And I remember going there and no one spoke to me. And I drank too much and fed cheese to a dog who was on the porch and then staggered across the road to lunch. So I remembered how that felt. And then when I was on faculty, I came there one day early and there was a waiter, a young guy, a waiter scholar, staring at a terrible painting on the wall for the longest time. And I just went over and began to talk to him. And he realized what I was doing because after we were done talking, he said, "Thank you for doing this." And I said, "I know how you feel." And I think that's a responsibility that you have as a writer, to be helpful to other writers. I was helped certainly by Anatole. I was helped by my students. I didn't know any writers when I began writing. And that created a kind of loneliness that was only filled by my characters who were inside my head talking to me so that I wasn't that lonely. I mean, I did have friends, but they weren't writers. So we couldn't have any discussions about writers and about writing. I'm sure we talked about books. I'm sure I read, but I didn't read the way you did. I mean, you went to a good college and you began reading important books at an early age. And I didn't. I had missed out on that by graduating and going out to work at 16. I wasn't reading Jane Austen when I was 18 and 19. Yeah. I maybe read her in my late 30s or early 40s. And you once said, "Oh, Mom, that's better because you're more mature." But I think it would be better to have read it in a group with people talking about it and somebody leading us through it the way your experience in college.
It's definitely exciting to read books for the first time like that with other people. Absolutely. I remember when you went off to Breadloaf, I went to 4-H camp. Now, who got the better deal? I'm just saying.
A miracle, because Breadloaf was the precise 12 days that you were at 4-H camp. Otherwise, I don't think I could have gone.
I know. But I remember looking at, I don't know if I ever told you this, looking at the brochure from Breadloaf and looking at the different writers, none of whom I'd ever heard of, and seeing one photo of a woman who reminded me of you. And I said, "I bet you're gonna be friends with that woman." And that woman turned out to be Maxine Kuman, the poet who became your dear, dear friend.
Well, Maxine Kuman, not only, but before she became my friend, she gave me a quote for the back of my first novel. I had never met her. I had hardly heard of her, but my editor, my then editor, sent her the book and she wrote the most wonderful thing. And in fact, I copied it on a piece of paper. And while I was in line at the supermarket going mad, I would open my purse and read what she had written. And she was at Breadloaf that first year when I felt I couldn't speak to her because she was on faculty. And then we met years later at someone's home and we threw our arms around each other as if we had been separated and were now reconnecting. And we became such fast friends that she always stayed with Dad and me when she was in New York. She lived in New Hampshire on a horse farm and she was quite different from me. I mean, there I was a domestic goddess and she was training horses. But it didn't matter. We had a real connection. And I miss her terribly now.
I was going to say the friendships that writers make, I think, can feel so moving and powerful because what we do alone. I was just going to joke also, what was her blurb that she gave you? Hilma shows great promise.
I'm not going to repeat it.
No.
It wasn't that. She was not quoting Miss Fredericks.
We do it alone, and it can be lonely, although you yourself have said, and this has been quoted on the internet, that you aren't lonely because of the characters in your head. Is that right?
Right.
Let's talk. We're going to get to a couple of questions shortly. So please, if you have more questions, put them in the Q&A box. But I know that people really are interested in what a writer's day is like. And walk us through, like, if your writing is going well, or going badly, but if you're in the middle of a project, whether it's a story or a novel, what's that like for you?
Well, it's like getting up. Amy Tan refers to it as going from dream to dream. Mm. You get up in the morning, it's as if the story or the novel has started writing itself in your head while you were sleeping, and you can't get somewhere to write it down fast enough. And if you're alone and free, as I am now, it was not that way when you kids were small. I mean, I had to get you off to school, and then you came home for lunch, and I had to fit my writing in. But now, I find I'm starting early in the morning, and the next thing I know, it's dark out. It's sort of amazing, and I forget everything. I forget how old I am until I pass a mirror on the way to the bathroom or the kitchen. And I find that I have to stop because I'm physically tired, but my mind is still working and maybe still writing. And I'll get into bed and I'll write on the margin of the newspaper because I'm too lazy to get up again. And the next day it's probably illegible.
Do you love it? Do you love writing?
I do. I like revising more than writing, I have to say. And even more than publishing, frankly. I hope my editor isn't listening.
Well, publishing in a pandemic is an experience that nobody ever thought they would have. I've joked that I want to write a memoir of the Zoom years called Do I Have to Wear a Bra for This? You know, I mean, it's like a strange thing where we're...
It's true. We don't have to ever get dressed as writers. But not no. If you gave a reading at a bookstore, a real reading, not a virtual reading, you did have to get dressed. Right now, though, I don't have to wear anything from the waist down.
But you are. Let's tell. But
yes,
you
I am. I must put that out there. I don't want to disturb anybody's thoughts.
But, you know, I remember as a child again, back when I was buying cards without the envelopes and looking up your friends, I would leave for school in the morning and you would be at the typewriter in a bathroom.
And a typewriter at the kitchen table.
Okay, in a bathrobe, and, you know, with a piece of paper rolled into it, and I would go off to school and do my math and my creative writing or whatever I did at school, my cutting out of pumpkins. And when I came home, you were still sitting there. And sometimes it was a good day and sometimes it was a bad day.
But I was still in my bathrobe and pajamas.
Yeah, it seemed a little bit not really like a real job. In fact, for me as a writer, your grandchildren, my sons. I remember once I was walking down the street in New York with my older son, and you know he had the same experience that I had with you of seeing a mother just sitting there, kind of looking bedraggled and writing, and not really, you know, not seeming to do anything.
Not gainfully employed.
No, not gainfully employed. And we passed a McDonald's, and he had just started reading, and there was a sign in the window that said "Now hiring," and he looked up and he said, "Mom, you could do that." Like, he didn't think being a writer was a real job because it's so interior, right?
And when you're not paid for it, until you're actually published and someone pays you for it, no one considers it a real occupation. I remember that it was thought of as this sort of nice hobby I had. And my parents, who would call in stereo, they would be on two telephones. And my mother would say, "What are you doing today?" And I would say, "I'm writing a short story." And she would say, "Did the sheets come from Macy's yet?"
Right.
And I didn't get any any credit for writing or any recognition of writing until that story was taken by the Saturday Evening Post. And I got enough money to put a down payment down on my first car, my first Rambler. And my father, when he heard it was the Saturday Evening Post, said, "Oh my God, I read that at the dentist." And it gave it such authority.
Yeah. It is time now to turn to questions, and there are some audience questions. This is the lightning round. So here is a question from Sally Baldus, who says, "Hilma, Sally Baldus,
you're from Sally.
Yes, from Iowa City." She says, "Always looking for your next book. So glad to be part of the Philadelphia Library Writers Series."
Sally, I'm so happy to hear from you. I hope you're well and happy.
And then Wilma Clemson says, "What a wonderful discussion. You've probably been asked this too many times, but can you tell us about Ending and all that jazz? I'd thought the movie was based on a hyperbolic fantasia of Bob Fosse's life. Didn't realize your book was the core. Thank you."
Well, what it was, not exactly the core, but Bob Fosse had optioned my first novel. And I assumed it was going to be made and that I was going to be rich and famous. I didn't understand how Hollywood works or doesn't work. And he decided that in the novel, the young husband dies of cancer. And I remember he told the screenwriter, who told me, that unless the character could get up off the gurney and start tap dancing, he couldn't really make this into a movie. He had changed his mind and he made All That Jazz instead. So it really was not based on my book at all. It may have been inspired by his desire. He himself had had a heart attack, and that brush with death and reading a book about somebody young dying, I think gave him that idea of writing, of doing a movie about someone who dies. But I think he found cancer too depressing.
Then we have, just very quickly, our dear cousin Jeff Haber says, "To my cousins, you both look fabulous. And Mom, I want to say that's true because you were joking before we got on the air that you look like Margaret Atwood's mother, but that isn't true. You look incredibly, you do not look like Margaret Atwood's mother.
Well,
I don't think anyone would say that.
I'm proud of being your mother. I wouldn't mind being her mother either.
She's pretty amazing.
She's pretty amazing.
Teeny Moskowitz. Thank you. Teeny Moskowitz says, "What a special night. Thank you. Thank you. Would you each talk about how the other influenced your work?"
Do you want to go first?
Oh, I was just waiting
for you. Younger?
Sure. Well, you know, it's pretty rare to grow up with a writer mother if you're a writer yourself. I feel that I have always... I continue to credit you with being so supportive of me as a writer. And I, in fact, something happened. I gave a reading. I put this into my novel, The Interestings, in a little bit of a different form. But I gave a reading somewhere. And during the Q&A, a woman stood up and said, "My daughter wants to be a playwright, but I know how incredibly hard it is to do that and how hard it is for women to do that. What should I tell her?" And I said, "Well, is she talented?" And she said, "Very." And I said, "And is she burning to do it?" And she said, "Yes." And I said, "Well, I think you should tell her that's wonderful, because the world will whittle your daughter down, but a mother never should. And you never did. And I think that's why I'm here in conversation with you as a writer. I think that it made me feel that we'll worry about the details, how it'll work out later, but to sort of nip something in the bud before it gets a chance to grow seems to me to be a mistake. But you always were encouraging, even of nascent efforts. So, and I saw you do it in action. That's feminism in action. I saw you in that bathrobe. You know, you were the real thing.
You saw it. But I felt you were talented from the very beginning, that if you had been given up to another family, you still would have been a writer. You would have developed as a writer. I think you're a natural born writer. And I also have a lot of respect for your opinion. And as you know, you and I exchange first drafts. After Dad, you were my first reader. You and Nancy, my two daughters, would read my work and give me some feedback. That wasn't as cruel as that man at the New School. but wasn't dishonest either. And I find that there has to be that fine balance between honesty and charity. You have to find something constructive to say that's helpful. And if you can find something that you really like in the manuscript, you should mention it, because the person may be unaware of a very good line. And if he sees it as his strength, then he or she can develop that. I think that's one of your responsibilities. I think you and I are honest with one another. And maybe we admire each other a little bit too much sometimes, but I think we prepare each other for what the world might think of the work.
Well, to take you down a peg, Mother, I've brought the man here tonight from that first writing workshop. No. Joking. Okay, the next question is from Stephen Simmons. Now, I don't know if this is the Stephen Simmons I know, but maybe it is or not, a writer, Stephen Simmons. But why did you think about your daughter becoming a writer? Is there a special kinship because of that?
I think it is. There is. I think we talk about the same things I talk about with her sister. You know, we talk about family and what we're doing in our lives. But I think we also talk more about books we're reading, other writers, some literary gossip.
It's less lonely, yeah, definitely. Here's a question from Julie Clam, a wonderful writer herself.
Yeah, indeed.
Who has a terrific, terrific book out right now called The Almost Legendary Morris Sisters, about her own family history. And she writes nonfiction. And
it's getting a lot of very positive attention.
Wonderful. Julie Clam says, I wanted to ask Hilma how the experience of publishing this book has been different from her past books.
The circumstances were so different. I think that that's, I'm with a wonderful publisher, Bloomsbury Press, and a wonderful editor, Nancy Miller, who has been my editor for other books. But I think the circumstances of publishing in the midst of a pandemic make this a very different experience. It's bittersweet. There's all this darkness, and then there's this great distraction. Before this, when I was writing, I was just distracted from ordinary life. I was distracted from the eggs boiling over or the doorbell ringing. Now I'm being distracted from a kind of deadly silence. And certainly in my household, where, you know, I used to think, if only I could have some peace and quiet, because I would be typing at that table in the kitchen with you kids yelling and the dog barking. And I would think, oh, you know, where is Proust's cork-lined room, and so forth and so on. And now you get what you wish for sometimes. And now I'm in a quiet place. And unless I open the window and hear some sirens or some shouting from the street, it's pretty quiet here. So in that sense, it's very different.
Laura Palmer, my great friend, a wonderful person, says, thank you, Hilma and Meg, for this wondrous conversation. Hilma, I wonder if while you were alone in the hospital with COVID, if the characters in your head and your ability to create a separate world was any consolation, or were you suffering too much?
It's so hard to remember exactly how I felt. My main concern at that point was for my husband, because his oxygen levels were dropping. And both my children and I were in touch with a wonderful doctor at his hospital. And he called us every night to report on his progress. So at that point, I don't think my imagination was much of a help.
Yeah. Sally Baldus says, and Hilma, my daughter's, one of whom is a writer not yet published, reminds me how important you were in her early years, but she's still writing and hoping.
Oh, but I'm so glad.
That hope, just, do you want to say something really quick about that, about rejection and how people should take hope? If I'm sure some of the people watching tonight are writing, and what, how do you keep going?
Toni Morrison said you need talent and a job. And I think that makes a lot of sense. you can't teach writing. You can teach writing to writers. And if you feel you're a writer and you feel connected to your work, I would encourage you to just keep going, because after that first terrible rejection that I suffered in that class, if I could go on, you can go on as well.
Right. Okay. Carrie Beauchamp says, just so enjoying being with both of you. Thank you. So thank you for coming. And let's see, Laura Palmer has another quick question. Were you surprised Meg became a writer, or did you see it coming?
She was such a precocious writer.
Was she?
I'm talking to her. I'm not talking to you.
I know.
Okay. Meg published her first novel at 22. I published my first novel at 44. The family joke was that my mother had until she was 88 and she missed her deadline. But also with the same division of numbers, Meg published her first short story when she was 11 in a children's magazine. So, you know, she was just a natural born writer. And when I began reading her work, I was so enthralled by it. And of course, I loved her because she's my child, as I still love her. And I would praise her, and she would really get angry. And she would say, you just love everything I do. And I realized that she wanted some respect as a writer, that she wanted me to treat her fairly. So I became a little more critical, whereupon she burst into tears. So I had to find that happy medium. But I think that she was a born writer.
Tanya Aldridge.
Scribbling in utero, Meg.
What's that?
I felt you scribbling in utero.
Yes. Yo, it's a horrible image, isn't it? A tiny little pen.
Yes.
Tanya Aldridge says, how many other women around you wrote? Because I feel women were not doing that much. I have enjoyed this discussion tremendously. You look great for all your years of experience, and thankful you got better after COVID.
Thank you so much. Repeat the question, Meg.
How many, were there other women around you?
Oh, no, I had never met another writer until I took that course at the New School, the advanced course. I hadn't met any other writers. In fact, one day when I did go into the city that day, a neighbor who played tennis gave you children lunch because you came home. My children walked home at lunchtime. I didn't even get a full day of writing.
I'm so sorry. I know. When I think about that now, it's horrifying for a writer.
And a backyard neighbor took you kids on that Monday so I could go into the city a little bit earlier. And she played tennis once a week, and I took her kids for lunch that day. So in that way, we helped each other out. But I didn't know any other writers. And but I had lots of friends, and we haunted the library. We lived in a town without a bookstore, which is pretty horrifying when I think about it, because bookstores were flourishing in those days. Fifth Avenue was covered with bookstores, and it was just marvelous. I remember going from bookstore to sign books when the first one was published.
Yeah. Now we only have like 7 more minutes, and we have a few more questions. So this is legitimately the lightning round, actually. Here's a comment from Joan Delfatore, if I'm pronouncing it correctly. She says, I was very fortunate to have Hilma, it went up, as a mentor in the Visible Ink program when I was making the transition from academic writing to more commercial writing. In response to your conversation about teaching, I just wanted to say, and I'm sure this is true, that she is a capital wonderful teacher, thoughtful, considerate, and insightful. I look forward to getting together again when circumstances permit.
And so, I look forward to reading your book when it's published, Joan.
And then here's someone who, this is Amy Gottlieb, my childhood friend and lifelong friend, who is actually the most bookish person I knew. We met at another friend, Cynthia's bat mitzvah, I believe. And she was reading Colette, and she told me to read The Bell Jar, things that I'd never read before. And Amy was just absolutely literary and is a novelist herself, a wonderful novelist herself. And she says, hi, Hilma and Meg. Wonderful to see you both. What is the most valuable writing lesson that you learned from each other? What are our quick answers, Mom? What do you think?
I think that you taught me to persevere, that I would be more inclined to give up. And I think that you're a very encouraging person. And
well, good.
And you, you set a good example. You also have taught me to take more time with my work. I tend to be impulsive. We talk about this when we do our cryptic puzzles at night. And when you get the answers, you understand why you got that answer, why you figured out that conundrum. So you're analytical. I just guess the answer sort of intuitively, and I don't care how it came to be. I just am so happy that I got it right.
It's true. It's so funny. We do, for what we're talking about, these puzzles are The Guardian in England. It publishes a cryptic puzzle, and they are those clues that don't quite make sense. They're not like blank Lupino actress. They're word games and puns and anagrams and all kinds of things. And we love doing them because we play Scrabble together. That's another thing, is that we share an absolute love of Scrabble and words and moving letters around and all of that. And you're right. I want to know why. I want to sort of really kind of dissect the clue and understand why it was written so elegantly, so beautifully.
And I just see one letter and get the word.
And you get it. And it's like a freakish, amazingly wonderful thing. And I think your work is certainly not freakish, but it is deeply intuitive. And I guess I would say that trusting your intuition is something that I probably have gotten from you too. You don't have to know why something works, but it's only later in revision that I think you will look at it and say, this part works, and maybe now here's where I'll make it better. I don't love revision the way you do. I mean, a lot of writers hate revision. It's nice that you love it.
I admire the fact that you are analytical and patient, and I see that in your puzzle making, puzzle solving, and in your writing.
Thank you. Mutual Admiration Society.
I'm not going to make you cry tonight.
No. I'm going to read one more, and then we'll just talk for a minute and wrap up. But this is Aviva Chansky Gutman, who says, I'm enjoying your mom's book on my Kindle, wanted to listen tonight to see you both. And she went to Indian Hill, the summer camp I went to in 1974, which was the basis of my novel, The Interestings. And it was a very important place. And Aviva, do get in touch. I'd love to be back in touch again. And I think that, and thank you for being here. And I'm so glad you're enjoying my mom's book. I'm incredibly proud of her. And I want to say, you know, seeing these people and hearing questions from writers and readers. I'm not going to wrap up. I'm going to say thank you for that. But some more just popped in. And this one in particular, I definitely want to actually quickly say. Julie Vick says, one of my mother's favorite books was Mrs. Bridge. My mother died of COVID 10 months ago. I'm very sorry to hear that. In her papers, I found some short stories she wrote, mainly autobiographical, for creative writing courses I didn't know she took. We talked a lot about books, and I miss that. It's a pleasure to watch you both talk with so much love for your writing and for each other. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. That's very moving. And I'm very sorry about your loss too.
Me too.
What a hard time.
It's a really hard time for so many people. And we have 2 minutes. I'm going to try to just get to these two things quickly. But, you know, I do think since Julie Vick mentioned Mrs. Bridge, and in your story, you talk about Mrs. Bridge, which is a novel that we both love very, very deeply, by Evan S. Connell, C-O-N-N-E-L-L.
And Mr. Bridge as well.
Yes, the two books about a husband and wife. Incredible books. Mrs. Bridge was published in 1959. It's about a Kansas City housewife just before World War II and her life. Books can be a great comfort, and as we all know, but some people felt that they couldn't read during the pandemic. And my feeling is that if you think about the reading experiences that you had in the past, you might be able to move forward and think about reading experiences of the future. Really, really quickly, yes or no answer here. And then one last question. After you finish a book or story, do you miss the characters after having spent so much time?
They're like friends who have moved out of the neighborhood, and I always wonder what happened to them. And that's why I write about them again sometimes.
Yeah, I feel the same way, particularly actually my characters from The Interestings. And then the last question, that question was from Bonnie Zedek. And this question from Josephine, I'm sorry, I don't know how to pronounce it, Njoroge. This is the greatest mother-daughter discussion team I have ever seen. Thanks to both of you.
Thank you. What a great compliment, Meg.
You want to take it on the road, Mom?
Okay, here we go.
You're going to have to do another book. But meanwhile, I know that you are going to write another story, I think, pretty soon. I feel it in the air.
Yes, I think I've given you that hint.
Yes, I'm so glad. Well, listen, everybody, thank you so much for joining us tonight and celebrating Today a Woman Went Mad in the Supermarket. I hope you read it. It's an absolutely stunning book, and I'm really thrilled to be talking to my mother about it tonight.
Thank you, Meg, and thank you all so much for coming and for your wonderful questions.
Good night.
Good night.
Thank you for listening to this podcast from the Free Library of Great Conversations. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information on the series is available at freelibrary.org/authorevents.